I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Both Barack Obama and John McCain embraced the idea of publicly financed, independently run charter schools as a way to reform the education system. But what is a charter school, and how do they differ from traditional public schools? Our guest, Nelson Smith, knows a lot about that subject. He's the president and CEO of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, and he joins us today to talk about what charter schools are and what they need to work. And they say all politics is local, but how political is the food you eat? Smart City producer Scotty Iseri found out when he attended the Eat Local Challenge at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. He'll find out how delicious it can be when the food you eat comes from nearby. All that plus our regular contributors Nate Berg and Walker Smith today on Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Nelson Smith is the president and CEO of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. The Alliance is the national nonprofit organization committed to advancing the charter school movement. I started our conversation by asking Nelson, what exactly is a charter school?
Well, charter schools are a new kind of public school. You know, if you think about the challenges of the 21st century and the international challenges that we face. Part of facing those challenges is to close the achievement gap in our own country. And as a new kind of public school that is free to innovate and held to high standards of accountability, charter schools are proven to be particularly successful at bringing kids who have been ignored or left behind by traditional systems farther up along the learning curve. And that's a way in which I think we're really contributing to closing the achievement gaps in the United States.
Okay, you've said several things I want to pursue. One, you've emphasized public charter schools. I think a lot of people get this confused. Let's make sure what we all understand each other when we talk about charter schools. What is the generally accepted definition?
Well, a charter school is an independent public school. It is operated usually on outside of the traditional district-managed school system. It operates on a performance contract, which is called the charter, which spells out certain goals that it must meet in exchange for a lot of flexibility and freedom from some of the rules and regulations that encumber some traditional public schools. So there's high accountability, and in exchange for a high degree of freedom to innovate. They are tuition-free, like all other public schools, and they are accountable to a board that is specific to that school and also to an authorizer, which is the group that under state law actually awards the charter and can revoke it if they don't meet the goals that are spelled out in their charter.
Now, some advocates for traditional public schools or public school systems will say, but charter schools can choose the students and the parents that they allow into their schools. Is that generally true?
There are a very, very few charter schools in the country that have any kind of selective admissions, but 99%, and this really is the rule, are completely open enrollment. That is to say, they have a certain number of slots. If there are more kids applying for those slots than there are seats in the school, then they have to enroll kids by a lottery, which means that everybody has an equal chance at getting in. They cannot discriminate on the basis of race, religion, gender, or prior academic achievement. So, for example, you will find a charter school that makes tremendous grades or has a particular academic theme, but they can't restrict admission to kids who are likely to do well in that particular theme or mission.
Tell me more about the nature of authorizers around the country. First of all, how many states allow charter schools?
40 states and the District of Columbia currently have charter school laws.
All right, and tell me about the authorizers, the people that, in effect, allow charter schools into business.
Right, and I'm glad you asked that question, Carol, because this is a very new phenomenon and very little understood. In the traditional model, the local school board both oversees all the schools and holds them accountable and also really manages the school system. It directly oversees the superintendent who manages the delivery of education programs. In the charter school environment, the role of the authorizer is to create that performance agreement to award the charter based on rigorous application procedures. and to spell out accountability goals for the charter schools and then to hold them accountable, but not to manage the program. The program is managed at the school site by the charter school operator, and they have their own board of directors at that school to whom they are directly accountable. But the authorizer is the body that actually holds the contract, if you will. And around the country, all sorts of different organizations and groups can be charter authorizers. Most typically, it is actually a local school board. They actually can award charters as well, but so are universities able to be authorizers in some states. In some states, there are even other nonprofit organizations. Here in the District of Columbia, for example, there is a board that was created by Congress to solely be an authorizer of charter schools. So they don't have any other business on their plate except making sure that there's a good supply of high-quality charter schools.
And isn't it Indianapolis where the mayor is the authorizer?
That's right. Indianapolis is the one jurisdiction in the country where the mayor can be a charter authorizer. And by the way, beginning under Mayor Peterson, that office has done a tremendous job of really looking at best practices from all the other authorizers in the country and incorporating them into their practices.
Now, even though charters have performance contracts and authorizers set out exercise accountability, it doesn't mean all charters are successful. What happens to those that are not successful in terms of producing students who are meeting academic standards?
That's right. I mean, I think, first of all, let me boldly say that the general feedback on the performance of charter schools is strong and getting stronger every day. But the world of reality is that not every school is going to make it. And part of the charter model, an integral part of the charter model, is that we not only reward and let the schools that work flourish, but the schools that chronically don't work, we shut them down. And since the first charter law was passed in 1991, something like 10 or 11% of the charters that have been awarded have been revoked and those schools have shut down. In the early going, it was mostly for operational reasons. You know, the school didn't manage its money well or something like that. Increasingly, we're being a little tougher on schools that may operate well enough but are not making their academic goals. That is something that we're actually, as a national organization, trying to be a lot more explicit about, that it is a part of the charter model that the schools that do not work for kids in terms of academic achievement have to lose their charter.
How long does it, is it reasonable to give a school to open, attempt to educate students, and say they're simply not performing?
Well, most charters last for 5 years, and many states set up their authorizing scheme so that you can't, let's say, close a school within 1 or 2 years on purely academic grounds. It takes a school a little while to get organized. And you have to remember these are always new kids. I mean, we talk about mobility in public school systems, and you have to remember that in charter schools you have 100% mobility rate most of the time because it's a new school and kids are coming from another environment. So it takes a while for any new school to get its footing. But most of the time, after 3 to 5 years, you can see whether the trajectory is right. You can see whether achievement is beginning to happen or not. And so that's the reason why the charter is no shorter than 3 years, most typically 5 years, and sometimes longer. The idea is to give the school a reasonable chance and to provide the resources that are necessary. But then if the school doesn't make it, then it's time to let someone else take a try at educating those kids.
Well, you've mentioned the question of resources, so let's jump into it. I've read a copy of the report you released with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Institute on how business can support charters, and the first thing I noticed was this statement. Still, charter schools face many challenges. First challenge, underfunding. On average, charter schools receive 22% less per student than district-managed schools. Most states don't provide charter schools access to direct capital funding. Now, when I read that, the first thought, Nelson, I had is, that sounds like every other public school argument. We don't have enough money. So one of the questions I have, and I think a lot of taxpayers have, is how much is enough? Isn't that the question taxpayers are asking about schools? How much is enough?
Well, enough, Carol, would be different in different jurisdictions depending on the cost of living there and depending on the type of school you have and whether the kids are very expensive to educate and need lots and lots and lots of interventions, or whether they come from more affluent families or whatever. But here's the case about charter schools. We say that we ought to have a level playing field for public education funding. And since charters are public schools, they ought to have 100 cents out of the dollar, just as the schools down the street that are managed by the district have. The big difference does often come in terms of facilities funding. Remember, public school districts draw on capital funding. In other words, the state has a capital budget for its public buildings. And that's how they build and renovate their public school facilities. Charter schools are incorporated as nonprofit organizations, even though they are public schools. But they cannot draw on the capital budget in order to build their buildings. So very often they have to go into their operating dollars, which should be going into the classroom, in order to take care of the bricks and mortar needs that they have of building, renovating, or even just leasing facilities. So that creates one big inequity in the funding scheme between most charter schools and other public schools.
Well, you make a very good point on the capital side. Let's talk about the operating side. When you say 100 cents on the dollar that goes to any other traditional public school ought to go to a charter, I presume that per pupil expenditures are actually calculated on the basis not of what really goes to the school or goes to the classroom, but rather you take the district's budget, you divide it by X number of students, and you get Y per pupil expenditure, which means, and one of the big complaints against traditional public school systems is that a lot of money gets sucked into administration, that administration continues to grow even when student populations are declining. So, first of all, have I made the right assumption about the way per pupil expenditures are indeed calculated?
You've made a pretty good assumption, but the problem is that it's really different in every jurisdiction. I mean, every state has its own method of funding public schools, and in some states there's a greater mixture of local tax dollars, in other states there's a greater contribution from the state. The essential difference, though, is that in a traditional district, the district typically allocates money out to the schools, you know, on the basis of creating so many positions for teachers and so many program dollars and so forth. Whereas charter schools get their budget pretty much as a lump sum, and they get to spend it and allocate it out directly. The problem comes not only in terms of access to facilities dollars, as I mentioned, but a lot of other funding streams are just simply put off the table in some state laws about charter schools. For example, transportation. If a charter school draws kids from around the city, typically they're not eligible for transportation dollars because they are schools of choice. We could make the case that in any system that has choice among its public schools, if they're going to transport some kids, they should transport all kids. But when you look at textbook funding and all these other categorical things that typically go into some of the state component of education funding, a lot of those things have simply been ruled off the table. So we begin with that disadvantage, but it's also exacerbated then big time by the lack of discrete funding for charter facilities.
You know, I want to go back for a minute, Nelson, to the concept of an authorizer. I've wondered why we don't just have authorizers in every community. In other words, have authorizers who have a couple of responsibilities. They accept state funds and local funds for school, federal, state, local funds for schools. They accept funds for schools. They take applications for people who want to run schools, including a traditional public system, and then they allocate and they measure and report results. In other words, breaking the relationship between the authorizers and the providers seems to me would actually be a very good idea, because for some reason, we've gotten into this struggle of, oh, charters are going to take money away from public schools. Well, charters are public schools. So it's an argument that just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, you know, you're right on the firing line. What are the arguments that the traditional public school systems, the boards, will make against charters? What are they scared of?
In most stark terms, they're scared of competition sometimes. I mean, it's the rare superintendent or school board leader in this country, unfortunately, that really sees the potential of working with charters and using them as part of an overall strategy for broader education reform. I mean, when you think about it, you have a pretty essential tension in, and you're asking about authorizers, in the fact that so many charter schools are actually authorized by traditional school boards. because on the one hand, they're running their own system, but on the other hand, they also have to grant a contract for their competition to operate next door. It's a little bit like asking McDonald's to locate a Burger King right next door. So one of the arguments that we make is, in fact, that there ought to be multiple authorizers in any state, that if you have a tremendous idea for a charter school, you might not get a great hearing at your local school district board, but you ought to be able to go to somebody at the state level or to a university to get a charter to start your school, because if you've got a great idea, it shouldn't be squashed because of a fear of competition. The other thing that's kind of happening more broadly in public education, and I think the charter movement can take a little credit for this, is the move toward really what you're describing, which is the portfolio idea of managing a large group of public schools, where the role for the central office, the board and administration, is not at all to manage directly everything that happens in the schools and in the classrooms, but it is to essentially manage the portfolio, decide who are the good operators that should come in and stay in and get rewarded for that, and really who needs to go and let the schools be put under new management. That's actually what an authorizer of charter schools does. And there are a certain number of public districts that are kind of looking at that and saying that might be a better, you know, more 21st century model for how we operate with all of public education.
Where is that conversation being held seriously?
Well, if you look at, for example, Chicago, where under Superintendent Duncan and Mayor Daley, the school district has moved toward renovation of its public school structure by essentially saying that they're going to close down big ineffective schools and replace them with smaller high-performing schools, some number of which will be charter schools, but some will be operating on contracts, and some will be operating as relatively autonomous schools within Chicago Public Schools. In New York City, Joel Klein, Superintendent Chancellor Klein, rather, has not only welcomed charter schools into the city as sort of a leading vector for reform, but has also created what's called the empowerment zone, in which those schools have a much higher degree of autonomy over their own budgets and over the school site decisions than in the rest of the district, and he's trying to expand that out. So you see a certain number of people who understand that the role of the central office can't be to micromanage what happens in the classroom, but it should be to be an accountability agent and, as I say, a kind of a portfolio manager.
Thinking about what's happened with the financial crisis in recent weeks, much of the blame is being put on deregulation. Do you fear that the pushback now on deregulation in the financial markets might affect the deregulation you're seeking in the education markets?
I don't think there will be that kind of relationship, because what we have here is not really a deregulation model. What we have is a different kind of governance model that provides the, if you will, the right kind of oversight and regulation. In other words, what we're looking at is not all the inputs and all the direct compliance. What we're looking at is, do you get the outcomes that we want with kids? Educators should be free to practice their trade. I mean, one of the original inspirations for the charter model back in the 80s and 90s was the idea of liberating teachers to be able to try new things in the classroom and not have to be encumbered by all sorts of red tape coming down from the central office. So the idea of, you know, having that freedom is central to the charter model, but a good charter authorizer will construct not only a contract that says after 5 years, did you make your goals or not, but a good accountability program that periodically looks in on the school and says, are you making the kind of progress that we expect? Are you in compliance with the laws on health and safety and so forth? And do we have a reasonable expectation that you're going to be on the right trajectory towards achievement of your goals? It's not a hands-off model. It's a model that has a very light touch in terms of oversight, but then very high accountability for outcomes.
You made a broad statement about charter schools generally being successful in terms of producing better student achievement. But I want to come back and ask you specifically, what is the research telling us about what students in charter schools have been able to achieve compared to their peers in traditional public schools?
Carol, the research is very encouraging these days. And let me just sort of start with what people sometimes might hear. They might hear charter schools are behind other public schools. Part of the reason for that, if you just take a snapshot of, you know, one test on one day, is that we typically bring in kids who have been behind, and sometimes significantly behind, their peers in other public schools when they come to our schools. So it takes a while for those kids to kind of, you know, for their test scores to start coming up. If you look at performance over time, though, and I would encourage folks to take a look at the achievement study that we have on our website that looks at 70 such studies going back over time since about 2001, if you look at performance over time, you find that the preponderance of the studies show kids in charter schools gaining at a faster pace than their peers in other public schools. 31 of the 40 studies over time that we have had that kind of result. The other really encouraging thing is that the closer we look, the better the news gets. In other words, if you use really sophisticated methodologies, such as one study of the New York City school system did last year, the news gets really compelling. In that study, they examined the sort of lotteried in versus lotteried out kids. In other words, these were all families that had applied to get into charter schools, and because of the limited number of spaces there, they were able to look at the kids who did succeed in getting in by winning the lottery, if you will, and those who had to go back to other public schools because they didn't make it in the lottery. And the achievement gain over 5 years, by the time the kids reached eighth grade in charter schools, was really significant. This, by the way, goes back to the question you asked earlier about selection. Sometimes people think that parents are more motivated if they send their kids to charter schools. Well, when you look at the lotteried in versus lotteried out, these are all parents that wanted their kids to have a space in charter schools, and you can directly compare the achievement results of those where it succeeded and those where it did not.
Yeah, that seems like a really fair comparison.
We'll have more from our interview with Nelson Smith in a moment, but first we go to Planetta's assistant editor, Nate Berg, for the latest in the world of urban planning and design.
So much of policy ends at the border. Whether it's a city or a county or a country, the edge of a place is typically the end of policy jurisdiction. But some issues don't stop neatly at the border, like water. With this in mind, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, has created a map of the world's underground water resources. The map shows all the aquifers of the world, layers of saturated rock and sediment below the surface that are pumped to provide drinking water and agricultural irrigation all across the planet. According to a recent article in New Scientist, more than 200 of these aquifers cross international borders. UNESCO released the map with the intention of easing international agreements over this shared and valuable resource. Knowing where these aquifers lie, experts say, will help guide water policy and determine when that policy needs to go beyond international border lines. And in Boston, huge civic projects are practically a way of life. The recently completed Big Dig freeway project was an inescapable part of the city for more than 20 years. Another huge infrastructure project, one less known but possibly more important, is the dredging of the Boston Harbor. For the last decade, the Army Corps of Engineers has been digging pretty much nonstop to make the harbor deep enough for the newest brand of large-scale cargo ships to get into dock. According to the Boston Globe, the $100 million project is entering its final stages and is scheduled to be completed by year's end. The dredging may not have had as much of an intrusive effect on the lives of Bostonians as the Big Dig, but officials estimate that the economic benefit of the harbor update could be equal, if not greater. Meanwhile, on Election Day in New Orleans, voters will find on their ballots an amendment to the city charter that could have a huge impact on the way the city is developed. The amendment would grant the force of law to the city's master plan. This means that all land use and zoning decisions would have to comply exactly with its rules. Without this force of law, projects and land use applications often receive exemptions, according to a recent article in the New Orleans Times-Picayune. The proposed change in the city charter would give the master plan greater authority over land use in the city, as opposed to the current system, which some say is too easy to bend. But critics argue that the master plan shouldn't be able to wield this much power. Not yet, anyway. The New Orleans master plan is still being written, and won't be finished until late 2009. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison. Coming up after the break, we'll have more from our conversation with Nelson Smith about charter schools, and Smart City producer Scotty Iseri takes us to the Eat Local Challenge in Chicago. You're listening to Smart City. And for our podcast listeners, we have a special message. Here's our producer, Scotty Iseri.
Hi, Carol. How's it going?
It's always going great.
The show is going well so far?
Well, that's for the listener to decide.
Well, speaking of our listeners, we have this really great base of podcast listeners, right? We have thousands of people that download our show every week. They come to our site, they click on the link, and they download our show, and they can take Smart City with them wherever we go. And we often get really great comments and feedback from them on our site. So we thought, why don't we create a site for our podcast listeners? It's called My City. It's got forums. It's a social networking site strictly for the listeners of Smart City.
Well, I think it would be fun to get to know the listeners better, because it's really, in a way, it's like getting to know the people we interview better. We're all in this together. We're all trying to learn how to make cities more successful, our own cities more successful. So I'd love to hear what listeners have to say, and love to learn more about what they're doing, the experiences they're having, what they see that's interesting, exciting, fun, cutting edge in their cities, some of which I'd love to turn into interviews.
Exactly, and that's what My City is all about. So what I'm asking the podcast listeners to do is email me, my personal email, I'm giving this out, and I'll send you an invite, join our social networking site, join My City, and make My City your city. It's Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com.
We look forward to hearing from you. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Let's return to our conversation with Nelson Smith about charter schools. We were talking about the achievement rates of students in public schools versus public charter schools and how to control the quality of education that children receive.
I mentioned earlier that your new report acknowledged or pointed out the charter school challenge of being underfunded, and I question you on that. I want to also say, to your credit, the report also says this: uneven quality. The majority of studies that look at change over time find charter schools doing better, what you just pointed out, than their district counterparts. But the quality of charter schools remains uneven. It's proven difficult for those who oversee charter schools to shut down unsuccessful schools. I mean, it does no good to have charter schools and have this accountability if someone doesn't hold them accountable. We get nothing more than we've had with district schools. So who's doing this well, and why doesn't it get done well?
Well, let me give you an example of the situation you just described. A couple of years ago, the State University of New York, which is one of the three statewide authorizers in New York, two statewide authorizers in New York State, and really one of the best authorizers in the country, made a very difficult decision to shut down a charter school in Harlem, where it was a safe school and parents loved enrolling their kids there, but the achievement gains just had not been what was promised. And there was a tremendous outcry in the community because folks said, well, we're going to have to send our kids back to the district schools. But the authorizer, the state university, said, you know what, we didn't authorize this charter for this school to be doing only about as well as the mediocre schools in the neighborhood, and this school is not fulfilling its promise. So they stuck to their guns despite all the political controversy about it. Parents, when they choose to enroll their child in a school, really develop a bond, really develop an affiliation, and they don't like to hear that the school is not making it and that might reflect on them. So it really is important for authorizers to explain in really strong detail, this is why we're doing this, and also to have a very transparent and public process. Meet with the community, meet with parents, explain why this is happening. And one of the things that I'm very glad to see that's happening with the movement is that when we have a shutdown, a lot of parents will still look for another charter school for their kids to go to. There was a notable example two or three years ago in California when a chain of charter schools that was really being mismanaged was shut down. And the California Charter Schools Association, which after all is an advocacy group, not only supported the shutdown and said we have to, in the name of quality education for kids, take action on these schools, But then they worked to place the kids in those schools in other charters, and about 80% of them enrolled in other charter schools.
In the report we mentioned earlier from the U.S. Chamber Institute for a Competitive Workforce, the report entitled Corporations, Chambers, and Charters, How Business Can Support High-Quality Public Charter Schools, you note five ways businesses can support charter schools. Tell me what they are.
Carol, we were delighted to work on this report with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because business really has a very critical role to play on a number of different levels. Number one, they can help actually build a robust supply of charter schools. They can work with the organizations that develop them, and sometimes they can have a very direct role, as in the case of New York City, where the investor Carl Icahn actually helped start a charter school that bears his name. Or the Ford Motor Corporation and the Henry Ford Museum started a great charter school in Michigan. So we can actually help bring new, good, quality charter schools online that way. A second is the human capital area. Charter schools not only need a strong support in terms of running their operations, and so that implies business mentorships and all sorts of help in actually running the business of the school, but also serving on the boards of charter schools. A very, very key part of this is that we need to have people with experience and skills who can serve in the direct governance role of charter schools, and that's a great opportunity for business people. The third is that, you know, charters are businesses. They don't have the kinds of services that are provided to other public schools by the central office. So working on developing strong back office operations, contributing skills around things like accounting and law, law firms doing pro bono work for all the, you know, multifarious kinds of things that charters run into. Fourth is helping to define and improve the quality of schools. We would love to see much greater business involvement where corporations have gone through their own quality processes, the ISO 9000 and so forth. Bringing this kind of thing into schools and helping school people review in a greater level of detail how their operation is working and how it can be tuned up. Finally, and I think in many ways most important, the business community can play a really essential role in trying to put together public policies that will make a supportive environment for charter schools to flourish. You know, in 24, 25 states, we have caps on the growth of charter schools, which means that when you do have a tremendously good, strong school, it can't replicate. We have the funding issues that we talked about. We have a need to create more authorizers who will do a, you know, constructive job of overseeing schools. The business organizations and individual businesses carry tremendous weight in their local communities and in their state legislatures. And if they would team up with our charter support organizations, the state associations and resource centers, around trying to develop sound public policies, I think that would be a tremendous new role for business around the country.
Nelson, thanks for joining us on Smart City.
Thanks so much for having me, Carol.
Nelson Smith is the president and CEO of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. He joined us from his office in Washington, D.C., and his interview was engineered by Jessica Forrest. When you're sitting down to dinner, do you think about where the food you eat comes from? We live in a globalized world that lets us eat bananas from the tropics and salmon from the Pacific Northwest all year round. But what if everything you ate came from local farmers and local producers? Bon Appetit is a food service company that provides cafeteria and catering services to corporations, colleges, and specialty venues. And each year, they issue a challenge to their chefs. Create a menu from items that are produced within a 150-mile radius of their kitchen. Our producer, Scotty Iseri, attended this Eat Local Challenge at the Art Institute of Chicago and spoke with head chef Brian Williams about the difficulties and the delights in eating locally.
My name is Brian Williams. I'm the executive chef. I work for Bon Appetit Management Company at the Art Institute of Chicago.
Brian, thanks for joining us today on Smart City.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about the Eat Local event.
Eat Local Challenge is something that's driven by Bon Appetit Management Company. It's something the company decided to do a few years back to encourage people to eat local ingredients, local items. We're in a global a global food chain right now. You can get whatever you want at any time of the year, and it's people have kind of lost sight of what it's like to eat local ingredients, something that's indigenous to where you're at, where you're living. So once a year we do Eat Local Challenge, and the requirements are every ingredient you serve for dishes has to be grown or acquired within 150-mile radius. And I can't go and pick something up 150 miles away that actually was 250 miles from there. So it has to be within that 150-mile radius.
You can't hit a grocery store in Wisconsin.
No, I mean, it's like, well, I've got this sherry vinegar, and, you know, I bought it locally, but it's from Spain. So, you know, something like that, I can't – that won't work for me. Can't use that. So I've been able to source a lot of local farmers, you know, to have beautiful ingredients, beautiful products that are available all the time. And it's local. Most of it's also organic, so it's a plus-plus situation for everybody.
How much contact have you had with the producers, the farmers or the growers?
Some of them I see all the time. One of the farms that I use predominantly for my my produce and my fruit for this event is Nichols Farm, and they actually are local all summer long at the farmer's market here. They're from Illinois. I'm friends with one of the family members, Nick Nichols. You know, I buy stuff personally from the farmer's market for my house as well as for the account here. Other farms, Gunther Farms, I get, for today in particular, I'm using duck, pork, and chicken from Gunther Farms. But on a regular base, even outside of the local challenge, I already buy pork and chicken from Gunther Farms. So something that's already on my menu.
Having that kind of personal relationship with your producers, what do you get out of that?
It's kind of camaraderie. It's nice to talk to these guys and ask them how they're producing the items. You know, what are they doing to grow these vegetables? How are they raising the pigs and the chickens? What's so special about their ingredients that make them organic, that make them taste so good as a cooked item on my side? And then, of course, they'll ask me the same questions too. It's like when I started to tell people that I needed items for Local Challenge, they were curious as to what Local Challenge was about and why it was important for me to get these ingredients from them. One gentleman who's a beekeeper, I asked him for an apple cider vinegar and some honey to make a couple of dishes that I'm using. And, you know, he said his apple cider vinegar wasn't quite ready yet, but he promised me that he would have it, and I ended up getting it less than a week before the event. So it's nice to have these kind of relationships with these people and, you know, be able to work stuff like that out.
So tell me, why is it important to eat local? What does a diner get from eating things that are produced locally?
Just importance of what's around you, what's good for the environment. A big thing right now, another company driven, at least by Bon Appetit, is we also utilize our low-carbon diet. We're trying to cut back on shipping of ingredients. Yes, you can get raspberries any time of year, but that doesn't mean you should. It's like right now we're going into fall. You shouldn't be eating stuff from the tropics. You should be eating stuff that's local, that's essentially in your backyard. I mean, there's beautiful apples and pears right now. There's some gorgeous stuff that's local that you're not having to deal with a trucking company, a shipping company, you know, excess use of fossil fuels to get stuff here when you can get it in your backyard or your neighbor's backyard, per se. Within 150-mile radius, there's such beautiful food here. Most of it, again, like I said, is organic, which is another plus, but you're getting great ingredients, stuff that tastes good, that's good for you. You're also supporting local farmers, small farmers that they've been doing this for a long time and by big corporations are getting, you know, pushed out.
So what's hard about cooking locally, eating locally?
Well, some of the challenges of Eat Local Challenge, within this 150-mile radius, I mean, we don't have, or we're not in a salt bed area, so I don't have any local salt. So that's one stipulation. I am allowed to use salt from outside of the 150-mile radius. I don't have the sea that I could, you know, dry some seawater and produce my own salt. Also, certain other ingredients that aren't indigenous to my area. It's like I can't get saffron, I can't get cinnamon, I can't get certain spices that aren't readily available to me that people have gotten used to. Like when dessert's always a challenge because I don't have a lot of local sweeteners too. I was able to use a local honey and turn that into a caramel as opposed to a sugar base, even though you think about beet sugar, but there isn't anybody producing it within 150-mile radius of me. So that's one of the challenges with something like this. And, you know, everybody's used to making salad dressings where you have different types of oil, especially olive oil. There aren't any olive trees growing around here where someone's going to press olives to make a nice olive oil that you can use for a dressing. So you have to kind of make compromises and adjustments when you're dealing with local ingredients. But that pushes you to be more creative with what you do have and what is available.
The Eat Local Challenge, this is a one-day event where everything on the menu is local. What percentage of the day-to-day menu is locally grown?
My everyday menu, I try to have a good percentage. I'd like to say 20 to 25% local. I always try to keep 2 to 3 local proteins on there. I'm about to change my menu, and I'm using another local farm that's going to supply rabbits to me. So I'll cut back on using locally raised pork and go to locally raised rabbits, still with a local chicken. A lot of the produce I use are from local farms inside Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, stuff that's, it might be a little bit further out than 150 miles, so it's not applicable for the eLocal Challenge, but I still try to keep a lot of stuff within a 200-mile radius for my regular daily menu.
I'm wondering, as a consumer, if I want to eat more locally, do you have any suggestions? Is there a website I can go to? Where do I find more information about local places to eat?
Well, from my company alone, from Bon Appetit Management, there's a wealth of information. If you go to our website for circleofresponsibility.com, there is a ton of information on all the programs that we do, and it also breaks it down by city and state to where you can find certain items, certain ingredients, and why it's important to utilize those and eat that stuff. Definitely worth looking into. In an environment like Chicago, where we are, especially during the summertime, you can go to all the local markets. There's probably one every day of the week, depending on where you are. There's Green City Market. There's the one over Daly Plaza. And a lot of these farmers, they're driving into the city to set up. You know, you're supporting them, plus you're getting great products.
So I'm also wondering about cost. How much does it cost to eat locally relative to your usual menu?
Eating local costs a little bit more from a restaurant standpoint, like what I'm doing, because I don't have the volume buying per se for stuff like this. As a retail consumer, if you're going to buy stuff from the farmer's market for yourself, there's no real cost difference. And in my opinion, the positive outweighs the cost. Especially buying for yourself, if you're going to go to the farmer's market, it's much better to go to the farmer's market and purchase all your fruits and veggies for the next few days from the farmer's market. The quality of the product is going to outweigh any cost difference from going to a supermarket or something like that. Regardless of the increased cost for local ingredients, I think it's better to use local ingredients. Some of the producers that I use on my regular menu outside of the Eat Local Challenge, I've worked out prices with them to where it's the same cost or a marginal cost from anyone else, and I'm using a better product. I'm offering my customers a better product. I think everybody wins. I'm supporting a small farm. I'm giving people something that has better flavor, better taste, and everyone's happy in the end.
How much is the transportation? I'm assuming that, like, a lot of the cost is transportation, right? If you're bringing something in if you're bringing beet sugar in from Idaho, it's presumably would cost more to bring that in than using the local honey.
Right, exactly. Everyone that uses any type of transportation right now is feeling how much it hurts just to travel. I mean, airfare's up, gas prices are up, and that directly affects restaurants as well. Whether it's brought here by airplane, boat, truck, or train, there's still a fuel cost. And as people using vehicles have to, they have to pay for their fuel, so they're going to pass that cost on to us. I try to not pass that cost on to my consumers as much as I can, but we definitely feel it.
This is an increase in quality. Is that just a function of the volume? You know, if McDonald's has to make a billion hamburgers a day, the quality is going to be less than a producer that doesn't? Or where does the increase in quality come from, in your opinion?
With the local farms, I think it comes down to being a steward of what they're doing. It's like the farmers treat the land with respect. They don't use pesticides. They try to keep everything organic, and it's a personal commitment, and that's something that Bon Appetit Management Company strongly believes in. I mean, we're all about sustainable food service. It's food service for a sustainable future. We have to treat the land and everything that we get from it with respect. Otherwise, we're gonna pay for it one way or the other. And I think growing things organically, treating animals humanely, and feeding them without added hormones and over unneeded inoculation of stuff is a way to produce a better quality, a better tasting and end result. Whether that's a fruit, a vegetable, or an animal, you treat it better, and it's going to treat you better at the end.
Well, shall we go look at some of the food now? So we're here in the Bon Appetit. This is the cafeteria.
Yeah, this is the cafe in the Art Institute. I've got an assortment of different things for Eat Local Challenge today. We're over at the Carvery Station today, and the Eat Local menu for today over in the Carvery Station, I'm serving in organic pork loin, organic roasted pork loin from Gunther Farms, and then some of the components that you can have with that are sautéed apples from Nichols Farm, roasted sweet potato, steamed Brussels sprouts, steamed green and yellow wax beans. Over here, we're offering also some local apples from Nichols for whole fruit, as well as pears. And then we're going to walk over to the restaurant.
So tell me your name and tell me what you're eating today.
My name is Ginny Hertzmark, and I'm eating the Eat Local Challenge prefix menu at the Art Institute.
How is it?
It is amazing. So far, we've had the butternut squash soup, which we're too polite to lick the plate, but would have under other circumstances. And now I'm having the duck breast with apples and Swiss chard. And it is perfect.
Did the fact that it was local appeal to you, or did the delicious menu appeal to you?
Well, both of it. I mean, you know, if it had been flown in from France, especially for me, I would have enjoyed it. But the truth is, it's fresh, and it's, you know, it's autumn, and this is a perfect autumn menu, and I know that it came from local farmers. It's very appealing.
Great. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Enjoy your, I won't bug you.
Thank you for making it beautiful.
So now we're in the kitchen of the restaurant at the Institute.
Now we're in the kitchen of the garden restaurant. For the garden restaurant, for Eat Local Challenge today, I set things up a little different in the restaurant. I put together a prefix menu, three courses. First course is locally grown, locally produced butternut squash bisque. I sourced a local cream and local butter, so you have that richness of the soup. The entree course is roasted duck breast, again from Gunther Farms, served with roasted potatoes, wilted Swiss chard, and an apple duck shoe. And then for the dessert course, we're doing a baked apple with an orange blossom honey caramel and a lavender creme anglaise. All locally produced ingredients, delicious, wonderful, and anybody that wants to support local farms and eat locally and take the Eat Local Challenge, they can order the prefix menu and have a three-course lunch that's just delicious.
Once the once the food is here in the kitchen, are there any, there's no differences, challenges, and are there any challenges in the actual making of it once you've decided to go local?
No, as far as production for us, it's the same as dealing with commercial ingredients or anything that we're getting from another source. Getting this stuff here is a little bit of a challenge because some of the local guys deliver only once a week or at a certain time frame. So getting the stuff in takes a little bit, that's a little bit of a challenge. It takes a little bit more effort and work to arrange that. But once the product is here, whether it's the proteins or vegetables, putting the stuff together is the same as any other ingredient. And as you can see in the kitchen, we've got three tickets hanging on the board right now. We just started lunch service a few minutes ago, and all three tickets that are hanging are people that have decided to take the Eat Local Challenge and are eating the Eat Local prefix menu. So that's a nice sight to see that people are committed to helping us with this challenge.
Well, Brian, I wanted to thank you for being on the show today.
You're welcome. Thank you. Want to try some?
I'd love to, yeah.
What would you like?
Sitting in front of a delicious plate of pan-seared duck with Swiss chard and baked apples, and I'm about to taste it. Let's see how Eat Local tastes. Wow.
First match here. I'm just kind of guy sharing. I'm going to finish this.
Brian Williams is the executive chef of the cafe and restaurant at the Art Institute of Chicago. To find out more about eating locally and see pictures of that delicious food, go to our website, smartcityradio.com. This week, Walker Smith gives us a little insight into how he runs his life. Our City Views commentator says there's an order to the chaos in those messy piles of paper on Walker Smith's desk.
I try to schedule all of my regular doctor appointments on the same day. I call it Doctor Day. I start early in the day, leave the middle of the day open, and then finish up late in the day. because I found over the years that you're less likely to spend time waiting in a doctor's office first and last thing. I know this seems a little bit over the top, but I do it in everything. For years, I have traveled 2 or 3 or 4 days a week on a plane. I prefer 6 a.m. flights. The planes are already there at the airport, so you don't have to worry about arrivals, and delays haven't had a chance to cascade through the system yet. Getting up that early, though, means fumbling around in the dark to get ready. So all of my suits are blue or gray, all of my shirts are white or blue, and all of my socks are black. That way, anything I grab matches. The only thing I leave to chance are neckties. See, I'm not completely obsessed with being in control. Well, okay, maybe I am. But you might not suspect this by looking in my office. It's covered up in piles of everything. Paper, newspaper clippings, magazines, old files, brochures, mail, you name it. But the piles are distinct. One pile consists of materials related to the social trends I keep up with for a living. Another pile consists of articles with ideas for these commentaries. Yet another pile consists of clippings about books and CDs I want to buy. And another pile consists of articles about Apple computers, and so on and so forth. And within each pile, there is an order as well. Book clippings on top, CD clippings on bottom, for example. This kind of over-obsession with order and control doesn't always work well, though. When I travel, I always carry way too much stuff. Over the years, my briefcase has hauled hundreds of pounds of unread paper all over America. And the stuff I insist on carrying in the car for vacation trips or in my kayak for paddling trips is no longer a subject my wife and I can discuss rationally. I'm sure there's a balance in here somewhere, but I'm averse to letting go. However, I know that I'm not as obsessive as some people. I was friends with a guy from Harvard on the college debate circuit back in the 70s who was so controlling about being neat and organized in every aspect of his life that he even used a ballpoint pen to fill in every letter O in all of his briefs and materials because he thought that gave them a tidier appearance. Now, I'm not that far gone, but I am not completely unsympathetic to his obsession over O's. And I suppose I get this from the fact that I am diabetic. I've learned over the years it takes control and discipline to live with this disease free of complications. If you don't keep absolute control over diet, exercise, stress, and medical care, then diabetes will wear you down. As ridiculous as too much control may sound, diabetes has taught me that there is something far worse, and that's no control at all. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. You can find our website, smartcityradio.com, from your iPhone, your BlackBerry, or your computer. And while you're there, you can listen to archive shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. Most important, you can get in touch with us and let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or email us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. Nobody ever told him not to talk with his mouth full. I'm Carol Coletta.